This is Main Street on Prairie Public, the time and place that we gather. Just like across those main streets across the state, we might reach out to our friends and say hello and figure out what we're going to do this weekend. Today on the show, we have a couple of our Friday favorites, a news debrief with news director Dave Thompson, and Madeline Reviews Game Night. But first, we've all seen comics. Probably a lot of us even read them. How much time have we spent thinking about them and how important they are, or if they're not important at all? Well, you're about to, thanks to friend of Main Street philosopher, Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. Jack, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, I'm really happy to be here as always.
Your show, Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, airs once a month here on Prairie Public, and your upcoming episode airs this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central, and it is about comics. Set us up here if you're going to give a 1 or 2 minute description of what this episode is. What is it?
The purpose of this episode is to say, hey, there's this thing that's been in front of you your entire life, and you kind of think it's fun and you kind of think it's silly, but you never really took it very seriously. And guess what? It's powerful, it's important, and it's incredibly interesting. It's the core of what we like to do on Why, which is take this thing that we take for granted and show why you should spend some time thinking about it and talking about it with friends.
Well, you got quite a guest for the comic world. Tell us about Scott McCloud.
Scott McCloud is this guy who in the late 80s and 90s wrote this series called Zot that was a sort of started off as a fairly traditional independent superhero comic book. But what he became really famous for is this one book and then what followed called Understanding Comics, in which he's trying to theorize what comic books are and why they're important. And what that means is, look, we have a lot of people looking at Picasso and saying why it's good. And we have a lot of people looking at the history of art and visual arts and how it develops through two-point perspective and three-point perspective and why there's abstract art. And no one thinks about thinking in those terms about comics. And that's what Scott does. He's not interested in the history per se. He's interested in the philosophy behind it and what is a comic and how do you read a comic and how do you approach a comic and what makes comics different than, say, The Simpsons or some sort of movie about Iron Man? Why are comics a unique art form? And that's and he's one of these guys. He's got TED Talks. He goes to comics conventions. He's a consultant. He's a teacher. He's a guy that people in the comic world have immense respect for and get excited when they meet.
Well, you said something that caught my ear, the difference between cartoons versus comic strips. How does he make that distinction?
Well, cartoons is a style of drawing, basically. That's at least what he implied. So The Simpsons and Family Circus and Garfield and Wonder Woman, they're all cartoons in some sense. Okay. What makes a comic as opposed to something else is this use of panels, what he calls sequential art, that when you watch a cartoon, when you watch The Simpsons, when you watch Iron Man, you're seeing everything in the now. You're experiencing moment after moment after moment after moment the way we do real life. When you read a comic, you are seeing now and then and before at the same time. If you look at a whole page of comic strips, you're seeing before, now, and after next to one another. And that, for Scott, is what makes it the art form. That by putting the panels in a slightly different way, you can treat time in a very different way. So he gives an example in the conversation. Imagine two different sets of panels. One is which someone's holding a cup of coffee about 1 inch from the table, and then in the next frame, it's close to their mouth. Well, that's a very slow movement in time, and it's kind of like a movie. It just happens nothing much is happening there, and you get the sense that time is slow, and you're paying close attention to details. But then imagine two other panels, one that shows a bunch of dinosaurs in a landscape eating leaves or whatever they're doing, and the next panel is an Arco gas station. Well, first thing that happens is you've got millions of years in between the panels. But the second is your mind creates a connection. And I'm sure all of our listeners have created the same connection, which is these dinosaurs are now this gasoline. And there's this thing in between the panels. He calls it the gutter. We sometimes call it the frame. But really, it's nothingness. It's this white space, or I guess blue space or whatever, between these two panels. And that's where your imagination engages. And that's where you as a reader make these connections, these causal connections, these temporal connections that create the story and inspire the mind. And so what makes comics comics for him is these multiple panels that play with time in order to tell a story that you as the reader have to make some sort of connection on your own.
So all the power is in reading between the lines, if you will.
I don't know that all the power is reading between the lines, but certainly how powerful you let it feel to you. Maybe I just repeated what you just said to me. But
I understand the distinction.
Because certainly there are more powerful and less powerful frames, right? I mean, you know, someone can draw a picture that makes you swoon, and someone can draw a picture that makes you cringe. And some people are better at that than others. How they're related is gonna dictate how much ownership you have over the process. He didn't use that term, but I'm using that term. But then there's this whole other thing that's going on. Anyone who reads comics online now will know that there's this whole group of comic strip artists who are not particularly good artists. They're not like the great horror comic artists of the 1950s. They're not the best superhero comics. There's a very famous comic now, beloved comic called XKCD, which is just stick figures. And yet it's brilliant, and it tells these great stories, and you have this emotional connection. There are other people who draw comics with just simple smiley faces. There's there's all sorts of things, and all these amateurs and all these newcomers have an audience with the internet that they never had before. And so on the superficial level, you might look at this and say, oh, well, this is bad art. These aren't good comics. But what he points out is no, it's the story that you tell. It's the emotional connection. It's the way that you get the audience to feel a connection with the story. And since comics are no longer controlled by these two or three great companies that are just out to make money, since they're all these independent comics and since they're all these internet comics, then the art form has no boundaries, and that makes it democratically accessible. It also makes it more experimental and more fun.
Well, and according to this guy's TED Talk, and again, his name is Scott McCloud, and he really gives a wonderful TED Talk. He's pretty big into the future of comics, and I think that really plays into what you were talking about, especially as they're existing sort of in this internet space, and there's just infinite possibility that there isn't just on a piece of paper.
So here's my experience. Okay, I grew up reading comic books. I read two basic kinds of comic books. I read the superhero comic books, and then I read, I mentioned before, these horror comic books from the 1950s. And then I went about my business. I got a PhD in philosophy. You know, I got tenure. I had a kid. And actually not in that order. And then for reasons, first because I had a kid, and then because of a friend of mine, I re-entered the comic book world, and I go to these comic book shops. There's one in Grand Forks that I love called the Dog Mahal, and there are all these comics that I've never seen before. There's 50 different companies, and there's comics from on everything from the superheroes you would imagine to these stories of people going to the dentist. There's graphic novels that we hear about in college and in magazines. But then there's adult-oriented comics. There's comics with violence and sex. But there's also comics, you know, about any little thing. Well, this wonderful comic called Paper Girls, which starts out with these group of middle school girls and early high school girls who have paper roots and then encounter aliens. But, you know –
Like you do.
Sure. I mean, it's just another everyday experience here in the Great Plains. But, and all of a sudden I'm faced with this universe of possibilities, of sophistication, of experiment that I had no idea was there. So on the one hand, it's completely overwhelming and really exciting. But then I'm an old guy, 48 years old, my body's falling apart, and one of the things that goes is my eyesight. And I pick up these comics, especially the older comic books that I like, and I can't read the text. It's too hard. And so I get these digital readers from my iPad, and I can zoom in and I can zoom out. And suddenly I can see one panel on the whole screen, and I can read the text, and it doesn't make me feel like I'm 87 years old anymore. But then there's a problem. And the problem is, if I'm looking at an individual panel and I'm not looking at the whole page at once, am I destroying the comic experience? Am I being unfair to the artist? If I look at the whole page and I can't see the details in the panel, am I missing something central? And so one of the things that interested me about the conversation, one of the things that I wanted to focus on in the show, is this, my own experience in this comparison of having this universe of new comics accessible to me, and yet at the same time, them being really hard to read because I just don't see the way that I used to.
Do you think that we as a society are taking comics more seriously now than before?
I don't know if we as a society are taking them more seriously, but I do think there is a much bigger place for people who do take them seriously. And what I mean by that is, you know, we still think of comics as superhero comics. And when we think of superhero comics, we're actually thinking less of the comics and more of the movies, right? Black Panther, Iron Man. Marvel does it very, very well. DC has been doing it not so well. but Marvel has been doing it very, very well. And so in our brain, Robert Downey Jr. is Iron Man. And so the mass culture and the success of the superhero movie has sort of in our mind replaced what a comic book is. But there's this world of comic lovers and comic readers and comic collectors who have these spaces that are themselves taken very seriously. There are, in fact, two comic shops in Grand Forks that have communities that people hang out in and buy used comics and new comics. And one of them focuses on gaming. I apologize. I can't remember the other one. But they're a combination comics and gaming store. And then there's the Dog Mahal, which is a combination comics and music shop. And then they have food, great hot dogs and things like that. And it's a clubhouse. It's a social club in addition to a comic book store. And so what's happened in the last couple decades is that while on the large screen, most people probably aren't thinking about comics any more than they would have, when you zoom in, there are these little worlds of impassioned people who have access to things that they never would have had access before because the internet exists, because the world is more tightly knit, and because people who love comics love comics with a passion that, you know, is all-encompassing.
One of my favorite Calvin and Hobbes comic strips of all time is Calvin comes in and says, "Hey, Hobbes, Mom said that we can go to the zoo. Do you want to go to the zoo?" And then Hobbes says, "Well, can we go to the jail afterwards?" How do comics advance difficult conversations?
You know, that's a great question. And the first thing is, as far as I can tell, Calvin and Hobbes is unique in the comic world. People love Calvin and Hobbes the way that they don't love anything else. And I think that's because Bill Watterson manages to take innocence and angst and sophistication and combine them in a way that we all find really natural. Calvin is beloved and not threatening. Hobbes is in some sense threatening because, you know, he's a tiger. But also he's cuddly and plushy. And we know the love for stuffed animals, and we all want to hug a tiger in the abstract. And yet we all also want to say everything that we want to say and know that we can't. And so these two characters together, named, by the way, after two very famous philosophers, John Calvin and Thomas Hobbes, are allow us the freedom to ask and say challenging and threatening and incisive things without feeling that challenge and without feeling that threat. And so that comic strip that you were just describing, right, we call it the zoo, but if we're going to take Hobbes seriously, then what we have to recognize is it's slavery, it's imprisonment. And we know that, and we know that because we have watched the old zoos fall away. We've watched the Minot Zoo change and the Winnipeg Zoo change because you no longer are supposed to keep tigers in these 10 by 10 cages. You need vast expanses. And the folks in Winnipeg are converting their zoo to a polar animal zoo. And so they have these great polar bear spaces that you can walk under through tubes and get this experience, because the insight that Hobbes is offering in that comic strip is an insight that we know to be true and is so morally compelling that the last 25 years have seen a radical change in what it means to be a zoo. And I think that comics, because there are no rules to the world that that comic artists can create, there are no limits, sorry, and they can make their own rules, then they can do anything they want. For example, right, if you look at the sort of the old guard of the comics, the Marvel and the DC, and you look at the female characters and the female superheroes, they're buxom, they're scantily clad, their Supergirl is kind of embarrassing in her sex dollishness, for lack of a better term.
Thank you.
Yeah. but you look at the independent comics that are written by women, that have women audiences, and that have boys and men who are more interested in the creativity than the prurient aspect of the comic book. And the women are liberated, interesting, sophisticated, deep characters who are no less important and no less valuable than the men. And so we can have that battle in the comic strips and in the comic books in a way that doesn't have the ferocity and the intensity that it would have if it's on Fox or the letter page of the local newspaper, because it's supposed to be fun and interesting and challenging in that artistic way. And yet at the same time, it's art. And since it's art, it's about us and our culture and our debates. And that means it's about anything we want it to be. And if you don't like it, you close it and you go to do something else.
We're visiting with Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein. He is a Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor of Philosophy at the University of North Dakota. And once a month, he hosts a program right here on Prairie Public, and it is called Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. And this Sunday's episode is with cartoonist and comics theorist Scott McCloud, and it airs at 5 p.m. Central. And Jack, I want to pivot here and shift gears into something else that you do. And that is that in Grand Forks, you actually have a senior citizens philosophy club.
This is right. This is one of those things that on a Monday night when it's scheduled, I think, oh, why did I agree to do it? And then and then when I walk out, I am among the happiest people on the planet. A couple of years ago, I was doing some philosophy work with a high school student, and there was a little article in the paper about it. And I get this phone call in my office from a woman, Marilyn, who said, I read the article that you're having these groups. Would you do something like this with senior citizens? And I said, sure, because pretty much I say yes to everything. and that is not an invitation to your listeners. And I guess, yes, it is. But and I said, okay, sure. And so we meet once a month, and I ask a question, and we talk about it, and we talk about things that not only are a specific question, but questions that change, the answers change at various different points in your life. Hmm. So, for example, this month, and actually they're going to be on their own. This is one of the differences between working with high school and college students and working with senior citizens. I'm going to be away this month, so I'm not going to be there, and they want to do it anyway.
So they just want to talk about you, Jack.
Sure, why not? As long as I don't know what they say. But so the question that I have set up is if you were king and queen of the world, what would your command be? But then I ask, how does the answer to that question change as you get older? Mm. And I think that's what's really interesting, because sure, that's a fun question, and I am sure certain things popped into your head just as things popped into mine. But if I were 80 years old, which I hope to be someday, and I could look back and say, well, this is how I would have answered it when I was 15. This is how I would have answered it when I was 30. This is how I would have answered it when I was 50. This is how I would answer it when I was 72. And this is how I would answer it now. Well, then I'm not really just learning about myself. I'm learning about how the world affects me and what lessons I've learned in life and how I didn't know things before that I know now. I think part of the issue, frankly, is that our culture, after you get to a certain age, it stops taking people seriously. In North Dakota, we like to talk about respecting our elders, and we like to talk about family values and those sorts of things. But the fact of the matter is that at a certain point, the older people in our family become sequestered in nursing homes or aren't too up to date with the technology or take a little extra care, and they become an interaction that requires a lot more effort than we like to admit. And this diminishes their experience, and it diminishes their intellectual capabilities, and it diminishes their role in our lives. And one of the things that I love about this group is that I'm not in a position there as I am sometimes with students where I know more and my job is to bring them to a point. With this group, you have – and it varies from 6 to 15 people depending on the group. You have these people have so much more experience than me and so much more knowledge that I want to figure out what can I ask and how can I direct the conversation so that they are saying things that I'm not going to learn for 30 years. Hmm. And they are so fun and smart and happy to be there and appreciative and welcoming. And it's unlike any of the other experiences that I have, because it's just – I'm just so impressed and so happy to be in a position where I get to see the future and I get to learn before I make the mistakes that I have to do in order to teach myself.
We have a minute left. Do they ever decide topics or at least propose a topic idea?
Sure, they do. Sometimes we talk about environmentalism. Sometimes we talk about books. There's a core group of people, and we have suggestions, but they're often just happy to have me suggest something. And sometimes I ask a question, and then we never talk about it again. Right? You know, we just follow the conversation. It is the second Monday of every month at 5 o'clock in the Campbell Library, which is in East Grand Forks. It's free. Often there are snacks. I won't be here this Monday, but hopefully I'll be there most other Mondays. Please come, call the Campbell Library for directions, or go to whyradioshow.org. That's where all of my archives are, but also there's a link to the Senior Citizens Group there. Everyone who's listening to this is welcome. You don't have to be a senior citizen to come. We have college students who come. We've had high school students who come. Come have a conversation, enjoy talking, and the more the merrier.
Jack Russell Weinstein, professor of philosophy at UND and host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. Jack, thanks as always for joining us.
Oh, it's so much fun. Thank you.
Still to come on Main Street, we have our news discussion with Dave Thompson, and Matt Olean reviews Game Night. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. An interim legislative committee will be looking at ways to raise more money for highway construction and repair. The state has traditionally used proceeds from the gasoline tax to match federal transportation dollars. During the oil boom, lawmakers used money from oil tax revenues to supplement the state's share. There had been some talk of increasing the gas tax, but one of the members of the Interim Government Finance Committee says that may be a non-starter.
I remember in the session, I think 2005 was when we raised it, maybe the last, I think 2005 raised it the last time. And that was a tough go back then, and I'm sure it wouldn't be any different now.
Castleton Republican Senator Gary Lee says he thinks the committee will try to find other ways to raise revenue for roads rather than a gas tax increase.
I think we'd have to raise substantially in order to make it work. I'm sure the feds are looking at the same thing, raising that tax. So it would affect the state quite a bit, I think, in terms of a tax that would have to go up federally and statewide to make a difference across the country.
At the national level, there's been a lot of talk about toll roads, but the chairman of that committee, Fargo Senator Ron Sorvog, says he doesn't see that happening in North Dakota.
I come from Fargo. We had a toll bridge. It wasn't never well received. It's very well received now that there's no longer a toll on it.
Sorvog's committee will make recommendations to the 2019 legislature. It's been 5 years in the making, but a plan to revise federal banking rules under the Dodd-Frank Act is on its way.
We're hopeful we can get across the finish line in the Senate, that the House will pass it quickly, and we'll get it on the president's desk.
Senator Heidi Heitkamp had a chance to speak with Fargo area bankers about the legislation. She says she will cut red tape for smaller financial institutions. North Dakota Bankers Association President and CEO Rick Clayburgh says the Dodd-Frank legislation was enacted at the height of the economic downturn as a way to identify what he says were the bad actors. He says Senator Heitkamp worked with Republican leaders to craft the bill. Clayburgh says community banks and credit unions have been unnecessarily shouldering regulatory burden.
In parts of North Dakota, because of the regulatory reform that occurred, mortgage lending virtually seized up. And customers couldn't get a mortgage loan, a basic mortgage loan, in rural North Dakota. This bill will allow that, will free that up, allow banks to hold mortgages in their portfolio, allowing them to serve their customers and do what they do best, and that's serve their customers and their communities.
Heitkamp says the bill passed the Senate Banking Committee in December. It's hoped the bill will be taken up on the Senate floor next week. And Minnesota lawmakers could soon be debating the place of God in the public schools. Minnesota State Senator Dan Hall has introduced a bill requiring school boards to install a durable poster or framed copy of the motto, "In God We Trust," in every school building. Administrators would be allowed to seek private dollars to accomplish it. Hall says it has much to do with American history as it does with religion.
So this is "In God We Trust." It's not "In Jesus We Trust" or "In Muhammad We Trust." It's "In God We Trust." I think it's time to do some of those things and encourage the people of faith.
August Berkshire of the group Minnesota Atheists says it's a bad move.
It violates separation of church and state by making it look like the school takes an official position on whether or not a God exists.
A companion bill in the Minnesota House hasn't yet been introduced. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This week on Away with Words, the lingo and lore of dog sledding in Alaska.
As you guys may or may not know, Fairbanks is one of the dog mushing hubs of the world. I run the dog sledding tours with my husband, and then my husband is also running the Iditarod, the 1,000-mile race that starts in just a couple weeks.
The next morning you were going to sing, "Oh God, oh God."
Join us.
There's no such thing as perfect. The best you can hope for is good enough.
That's Away with Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
All right, well, there's that old school noise of the teletype letting us know that it is time for our in-depth news discussion with News Director Dave Thompson. He joins me from our Bismarck studio. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
You bet, Ashley. Glad to.
All right, let's start with revenue collections on track with the budget forecast.
They're very close to being on track, but it's been a change from 2 years ago where the revenue collections were falling short of projections. Now it seems to be within 2%, which is a good thing, and it shows that the state is really on track to meet its budget goals, which is good. As I said, you know, when the legislature met in 2017, there were shortfalls, there were allotments, and there were budget cuts, as we all are well aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But so at least this looks good from a revenue perspective now.
What was behind the slowdown and the growth? Is this all tied to commodity prices?
Well, a lot of it is tied to commodity prices because, you know, a lot of sales tax that was expected came from drilling oil. So when drilling slowed down, sales tax collection slowed down. Now drilling's picking back up and we're seeing some more sales tax collections. And people are now buying things like cars and appliances where they're paying sales tax. And we're seeing that pick up. You know, it isn't yet to where we were during the boom cycle, but it looks a lot better than it did, say, 2 years ago.
Does that mean that some of the organizations who faced pretty severe budget cuts might be seeing a reprieve?
We don't know yet because, of course, there are things that what they call cost to continue. When the legislature comes and meets in 2019, there will have to be some built-in increases because of just the overall cost of doing government is affected by inflation. So that may eat up some of that, but there might be a little bit of wiggle room this time.
Okay. Max Schneider is running for Congress. This is presumably because the seat is about to be vacated by Kevin Cramer, who has announced he's running against Senator Heidi Heitkamp.
That is correct. And, of course, there are two Republicans. Well, there are several Republicans who are also seeking the seat. And now we have three Democrats who are seeking that seat. Ben Hansen was out first, and he's been campaigning since, I think, before Christmas. And then John Grabinger from Jamestown announced. And then Max Schneider, who may have an advantage, and I don't know for sure on this because the other two are working too, but the conventional wisdom says that Max Schneider, because he was a longtime legislator and he was the Senate minority leader, he might have a little bit of an advantage in terms of name recognition. But I think that's going to be interesting when they get to the convention next weekend to see how that all kind of shakes out a bit.
What's his platform, or at least the main ones?
I think you're talking about some, you know, he's kind of a moderate type Democrat. So he said that he would support President Trump on some things and some things he would oppose President Trump on. So I think he's talking about, you know, being cautious of spending, being cautious of, you know, going too far with getting rid of some of the regulations. And he's kind of rolling some things out, you know, so he is more on the moderate side of the Democratic Party.
Mm. What might happen at the convention next weekend with three people who have announced running for this seat? Is it the kind of thing where the convention decides which one gets to go? Or
it certainly will. That's how the conventions work in North Dakota. We don't have a primary per se until after the conventions are over. And I have not checked with the candidates. So whoever gets the endorsement, is there going to be a primary challenge come June? That's always an interesting. In the Republican side, in the House race, it's State Senator from Dickinson, Kelly Armstrong, versus State Senator from Grafton, Tom Campbell. And Kelly Armstrong said he will not challenge if he does not win the nomination. Tom Campbell, I have not been able to get a hold of him to find out what's going on. But in terms of the Democrats, I think it's possible there could be a challenge, and you never really know until you get to convention what's going to happen.
Hmm. Senate Majority Leader likes a proposal to use the Legacy Fund for infrastructure phones. So
right.
For anyone who's not familiar with the Legacy Fund, start there.
The Legacy Fund takes a percentage of the oil taxes that are collected and puts it in a rainy day fund that is supposed to be a permanent fund that you can live off the interest of it. And already we're seeing the legislature use some of the interest from it. But one thing that's being floated as an idea is to use it as a place to borrow some money. So you borrow money, then you pay it back with interest if you're a local community who needs some infrastructure, for example, like flood control or like this Red River Valley Water Supply Project to bring the Missouri River from Bismarck to Fargo. They're talking about that type of thing. And, of course, it would be a loan. There would be an interest rate. And that the legislature we're going to have to wrestle with a little bit. Now, constitutionally, I believe that you can use up to 15% of the principal in terms of, you know, getting a vote of the legislature to do that. So whether or not that will limit the loans that are available, who knows? But you've got a fund with over $5 billion in it, so it looks like a pretty good place to have this kind of lending opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Is there a lot of opposition to it?
Well, there's some opposition. There are some Republicans in the House especially who believe that the Legacy Fund should not be touched and that the legislature should actually be pouring more of the interest money into the Legacy Fund. Well, the legislature this past session did have to tip into that that interest to help balance the budget. So there's not a lot of support for that view, but in terms of having it to be a place where you can borrow money from and pay it back, that might be a more in-depth discussion because I know there's a proposal out there that's talking about maybe 1.5% or 2% interest rate. Maybe it'll go like a 3% interest rate or something like that to ensure that that legacy fund is still going to make money.
Is it the kind of thing that could have the potential to speed up infrastructure projects? So often when you try to find funding for a countywide project, you've got to wrestle with, you know, taxes or working with the state or sometimes federal money.
Exactly. And that's the point that I think Senate Majority Leader Rich Warden is making. Said, look, these things need to be done. The sooner we get them done, we can hold down costs, because the cost is going to increase the longer you wait. And we've already seen that on some of the projects. For example, if you're talking about the Fargo Diversion Project and the Flood Control Project, because there's been some delays in the schedule, the price has gone up. And that's kind of a natural thing. You know, the longer you delay something, yeah, the more you're going to raise the price. And a good friend of mine who's a reporter for the AP was talking to one of the legislators and said, you know, it's like that old STP commercial, if you remember that. You can pay me now or you can pay me later.
That's a good one. Election training, including cybersecurity here.
Most interesting thing, and I kind of stumbled on this story. I knew there was going to be election training, but I didn't know that this federal group was coming out to talk to the county auditors about being very careful with cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. As they said, you know, everything is electronic nowadays. It's electronic voting systems. And their IT systems kind of have a target on their backs from hackers, whether they be in the United States hackers or from other, you know, state operators. And, you know, we think about the Russians and how they might have tried to influence the 2016 elections. And there's some concern that they may try to do the same thing in 2018. So they were giving some tips on how local county auditors can help prevent this from happening. And they're good common sense tips, but, you know, good to be a refresher course on that.
Sure. How old are the machines that the state is using?
2004. And I know the Secretary of State, Al Jaeger, in the 2017 legislature asked for an appropriation to replace those machines, was turned down. Mm. And these machines are based on a Windows platform that is no longer supported, and they can't get some parts for it. So some counties have had to use older machines, kind of cannibalize parts to make sure they have machines that work. These things were bought in the Help America Vote Act, which was, you know, early 2000s. And, you know, software does change, hardware does change, and they need to make some upgrades if they want to keep these systems going. That's the point they're arguing and will argue in the 2019 legislature.
Do some people just want to go back to paper and pen or pencil?
You have heard that, and that is a backup. As a matter of fact, in talking to some of the election officials at the state, they said, you know, if all else fails, we do have paper backup. And the thing that's a problem with paper, it's going to take a lot longer to find out who may win some of these close races.
Got a minute left here. There's a group proposing a minimum wage increase in North Dakota. The current wage, $7.25. They want it to go up to $9.83 mm-hmm. in 2019, $12.41 in 2020, and $15 by 2021.
And then after that, it would go up, yeah, as an inflation type thing.
What's their main argument for this, and what's the reaction?
Their main argument is that North Dakota still, even though not a lot of places are paying minimum wage, we're still one of the states that a lot of people are holding down two jobs to make ends meet. And they say if you put a floor at 15, maybe some of these people can give up one of the jobs to somebody else, and they can make it easier to make ends meet. And when I say the minimum wage is, you know, kind of a rare breed in North Dakota, you see it all over the places that even fast food restaurants are offering $11, $12 an hour.
How about the small business owners? Are they commenting?
Not yet. I think they're kind of seeing what's going to happen with this.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Madeline is next.
I am an Arab American Palestinian Christian Lutheran pastor in Southwest Brooklyn running for office.
On the next Radio Lab, the story of an unlikely candidate from one of the most diverse and divided districts in America.
This is our country.
I have never in my life faced anything like this.
I don't understand what this means for the Arab American community.
It is very personal.
Meet Father K on the next Radio Lab.
Saturday at noon, 11 Mountain. Right here on Prairie Public.
Well, there's the fanfare. That can only mean one thing. It's time to find out if there's another movie out there worth going to see. Madeline, our movie critic. Matt, thanks for stopping by.
There's always a movie worth seeing, but this is sort of the slow time.
Okay.
We talked about how Black Panther took advantage of this slow time to make zillions of dollars. And what I mean slow is most people – no, I shouldn't say that. Most people have not seen all the Oscar films like I have.
Right.
But they've kind of siphoned their way out of theaters. There are still some around, so check your listings if you missed a few.
I did see Lady Bird last night, but on DVD.
Good. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did. I really did. Maybe I cried.
It's very good. It's the time now where these films that are being released are sort of dumped into this time period. But Game Night is an R-rated adult comedy with Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams that I saw. And if you're looking for a couple's night out to see an R-rated adult comedy, this is probably the one to see.
Okay.
It's not a bad little film. It's about a couple, Jason Bateman and Rachel McAdams, who enjoy playing games. They have game night with two other couples that they are friends with. And things escalate when Bateman's brother, played by Kyle Chandler, arrives in town, and he wants to make it kind of a murder mystery night with all kinds of weird role-playing and things like that. And obviously, to have a good film, there's a weird twist that happens, and I can't reveal what that is. So that's really the plot of the movie. It's actually pretty funny in parts. There's some amusing gags, but really Bateman and McAdams make the film. They kind of have a 30s crazy comedy chemistry, kind of William Powell, Myrna Loy, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, those old films. They really have a good byplay off each other. Bateman is just naturally funny. He's the king of snark. He's so funny. But McAdams does not play second fiddle. She has a fantastically funny scene where she tries to pull a bullet out of his arm. Why it got there, I won't tell you. And that's a hilarious scene that she plays very well. She's very good at comedy. She's kind of known as kind of a rom-com actress.
Mm-hmm.
But she is an Oscar nominee as well a couple years ago for Spotlight, right? So she's very funny. But really stealing the movie is an actor named Jesse Plemons. Now, people may remember him from The Post. He's also in Hostels right now. He was in Black Mass. He plays their neighbor who plays a police officer who's recently divorced, and he's creepy. He's constantly out in the driveway looking at things. He used to be in Game Night with them before he got divorced. Now he's not involved. He wants to get back involved, and he is deadpan funny in this film, and he really almost steals the movie. So it's not a long film. It's about an hour and 40 minutes. It's not a masterpiece. It's not a great film, but there are some pretty funny moments that I think people will enjoy. And if you're looking for something right now to shut your brain off and just go laugh, this is probably the film.
Okay, so sort of like a Hangover kind of genre.
Yeah,
like,
not as raunchy as Hangover,
okay,
but certainly kind of like Cards Against Humanity type, you know, film,
okay,
with adult humor and things like that. And there's some interesting lines and some innuendo lines, things like that. A lot of weird characters pop up in the film. Mm-hmm. So I want to credit the screenwriter, Mark Perez. He did a nice job with the script. The directors are John Francis Daly and Jonathan M. Goldstein. It's making pretty good money. I think it debuted at about $18 million. Again, I don't think this is a film anybody will remember come Oscar time. It's probably a film people won't remember 4 or 5 months down the road. But right now, if you're looking for something to go to in March, I would recommend it.
Okay.
But it's definitely R-rated. I don't think it's for kids at all. It's definitely one of those couples nights out type movies. Yeah.
Well, your big show was over the weekend, the Oscars. What'd you think, just your overall impression for starters?
The ratings were down, as you may have read, Ashley, way down. And I have a couple theories about that. I do think a lot of people don't watch live TV anymore. I also think perhaps a predictor of maybe an overly politicized Oscar show, and you can say politicized in various ways, may have turned some people off. I don't know about that. It's difficult to gauge these things, or maybe there's just so many platforms now for people to watch entertainment on. There's TV. You know, there was a time when the movies were the big deal, and now there's so many other things, television and Netflix and things like that, that I just wonder if maybe, you know, the Oscars' great day has passed. I'll always watch it, but the ratings were down significantly. As for the awards, I think I nailed all of the predictions. I thought Shape of Water had the edge for Best Picture, primarily because Martin McDonagh was not nominated for directing in Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. You know my thoughts on this film. I thought it was the most overrated film of the movie of the year. But I'm okay with Shape of Water winning. I wish Sally Hawkins would have got Best Actress, but she didn't. So no real surprises in the acting categories. Get Out winning screenplay over Three Billboards was a minor surprise, but I did predict that. Nice to see James Ivory, age 89, win a screenplay Oscar for Call Me By Your Name. And nice to see cinematographer Roger Deakins finally win on his 14th try for his great work on Blade Runner 2049. So,
and Jordan Peele made history.
Jordan Peele made history. You know, Get Out is a very good film. I thought it had a chance, Ashley, to maybe pull the Best Picture upset based on the weighted rankings that members are asked to do with their Best Picture ballots. That kind of gets complicated. I'm not going to go into it. But there was a thought that that was a less polarizing film than Shape of Water or Three Billboards were, and it would therefore appear like in higher ranks on ballots from 1 through 9. They kind of do a weighted system. So I thought maybe Dunkirk would have a shot, but I think it got released too early, and it won the technical awards.
Yeah, it won a lot of sound stuff, right? Wasn't that mixing and
everything? Yeah, sound mixing, sound editing, and film editing. But nice to see Gary Oldman win for Darkest Hour. That was never really in doubt. Allison Janney, tremendous in I, Tonya. I'm not wild about the Sam Rockwell, Frances McDormand picks because I don't think the film was strong enough. But
what do you make of Frances McDormand's speech? She ended it talking about inclusion riders, which is this concept that A-list actors and actresses can demand that there is more diversity both on screen and within the crew.
Yeah, that's something new that I had not heard of. And I don't think she had heard of it up until like a week before.
That's
and she was talking
yeah.
about it afterwards before her Oscar got stolen by someone. And it has been returned. I will report that.
I did not hear
yes,
that.
It was stolen at the governor's ball. So, I think if you have enough power in Hollywood, and certainly the five women nominated for lead actress all have enough power probably to pull something like this off, that's certainly something that is now at their disposal to use with inclusion writers. I think it's a good idea if people want to use it. You know, people are always still going to pick who they want to pick. It's sort of like the film industry is a really weird industry, Ashley. It's very much built on who you know, what your resume says, who you want as an actor or an actress. But I think inclusion writers are a good idea. And certainly this was a groundbreaking year in Hollywood with everything that happened with Weinstein and Kevin Spacey and James Franco not being nominated and things like that. And it's going to be an interesting next couple, 3 years to see if real change is coming. Or if a Greta Gerwig directing nomination is just a blip, and in 10 more years we'll have another woman director nominated. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. But it was a great speech. It was worth staying up to hear her speech.
Yeah, I thought so too.
Yeah, and worth it to see Warren and Faye get to open the
have
right envelope
redemption.
This year on the 51st
anniversary. I thought they were going to give the award to Gone with the Wind or something. You
that's
know,
what
make
I
a
thought.
Nice
it was going to be funny,
cheek.
But at least Beatty was funny when he said, it's good to see you all again. I got a good laugh. So,
all right. Well, I arbitrarily, well, kind of arbitrarily, picked a year for you to name Best Actor and Actress, and I based it off of the birthday of Jason Bateman. Mm. He was born in 1969. Mm-hmm. So Best Actor, Best Actress, winners and nominees. So films come out in 68.
That were released in 68 was Cliff Robertson for Charlie. Mm-hmm. And the others were Peter O'Toole, The Lion in Winter, Alan Arkin, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter, Ron Moody for Oliver, and Alan Bates for The Fixer.
Okay.
Actress was a tie, the famous tie between Katharine Hepburn, Lion in Winter, and Barbara Streisand for Funny Girl.
Mm-hmm.
The other nominees, I think, were Vanessa Redgrave and Isadora.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia Neal, the subject was Roses, and Joanne Woodward in Rachel.
Very good, very good. Do you care to say how many votes Catherine and Barbara got?
I think they were 2 votes apart, right? And by law, by rule, that's a tie? Or
this was an exact tie, according to the Oscars website.
Okay, tell me what it was then.
3,030, the first exact tie in a principal Oscar category.
Exact tie, that's crazy.
Yeah. All right, we've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
The Minot Symphony Orchestra invites you to saddle up and come on down to their annual Pops Concert. on Saturday, March 10th, as they featured the music of the Wild Wild West. Hear familiar works by John Williams and Aaron Copland. The evening will feature the world premiere of Prologue by local young composer Eric Michael Anderson. Enjoy other Western favorites, including The Magnificent Seven, Dances with Wolves, and The Wild Wild West. Tickets available now by calling 858-4228 or online at MinotSymphony.com.
This is Dakota Daybook for March 9th. When Dr. R.C. Little arrived in Mayville, North Dakota in November of 1919, he had a diverse resume for a 27-year-old doctor. He had attended Carleton College and the University of Minnesota, where he received his M.D. He was active in sports at school, including football, wrestling, and swimming, even winning the state backstroke title in 1915. He interned at Long Island College Hospital in New York before graduation and also did a stint as an ambulance corpsman with the Minnesota National Guard on the Texas-Mexico border. The ambulance was a mule-drawn wagon. Roy Casper Little was born in 1892 in Minnesota and served Trail County, North Dakota, as a general practitioner for 52 years. He delivered over 2,000 babies, including triplets, and never lost a mother. In his early years, many cases involving confinement were often handled in homes. He traveled in a variety of ways, including horse and sled in the winter, by car, and often on foot. Dr. Little's practice changed shape several times over the years, from an office over the Mayville Pharmacy to a remodeled house to a group practice clinic. His career stretched to such an extent that one of the babies he delivered eventually came to practice with him. Dr. Little was on call 24/7, but still found time for hunting and fishing when he could escape. He retired in 1971 and died the next year at the age of 79. On this date in 1975, family and medical staff honored him with the Dr. Little Appreciation and Dedication Day when a physical therapy unit was unveiled at Mayville's Union Hospital. A memorial scholarship at Mayville State University continues in his name. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jack Dura, Dr. Little's grandson. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
That's it for this Friday edition of Main Street. Coming up Monday on the show, we visit with Joe Strike. He is the author of Furry Nation, and he wrote this book about furry fandom. This is a subculture of people interested in animal characters with human personalities and characteristics, because he says it's one of the most misunderstood subcultures of American society, and he aims to clear up the misconceptions with the book Furry Nation. That's coming up Monday on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your weekend.